Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hello there. Thank you so much for joining me once again today. You know, it's always a pleasure to have guests come back and go deeper on their topics. And today is no exception. We have our first guest today is Andy Goal from Urgency Based Selling. He's been with us a couple times before. We've got some great reviews from his interviews. And we're going to go deeper. We're going to talk about what's going on these days that's causing people to be urgent about their urgency-based selling. So, Andy, welcome back. Thanks once again for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
My pleasure, my pleasure. I understand that you have been extremely busy since the beginning of the year, just getting tons of inquiries about your services. Tell us about what you do. We'll set the stage there. And then why do you think so many people are calling you now?
I work with companies to help them with business development, with sales training, sales coaching, helping sales management, really most things related to sales. I think that there's a seasonality to the demand, meaning that people probably didn't want to initiate a new project towards the end of the last quarter of 2019. And, you know, when the dial changed to 2020, people were ready to reach out and make some of those inquiries and start some of those discussions. Folks want to increase profitable sales, and they want to do it now, and there's the urgency. So the one thing I'll say is it's way more than I've ever seen in January. So I would attribute it to two things. One is concern about the possibility of a coming recession. We're overdue. And secondly, maybe my marketing's a little bit better than it was. I came out with a book in September. So I think it's a combination of those things.
That makes sense. Yeah. And, you know, a new decade, new year. I think there's a lot riding on this decade for a lot of, at least our listeners, because this is, you know, this is probably the decade that they're going to want to ramp up their business, make it look as good as they can, and sell it. And as we've said many times, if your business is an engine, sales is the accelerator, so you better step on it. So that's, you know, maybe that's it, Andy. And there's, you know, like you said, we're in an 11-year bull market, longest ever. People are wondering, when's it going to end? The economists are scratching their heads going, why didn't it end already? And they're saying, you know, can we keep this going? So maybe in contemplation of that, people are concerned about that. What are some of the biggest questions that they're coming to you with? What are some of the things they're saying you can help them with, besides, you know, increasing sales in general?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is that salespeople are not opening new accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And then second behind that is where a customer has an extensive product or service line, the customers are cherry picking, and they're pigeonholing them. So usually the number one thing is we want to open up new accounts, and the second is, you know, we want a bigger share of wallet. And then, you know, related to that is profitability concerns, because our sales team isn't selling strongly enough. If I could just say a word or two on that, there are two neurotransmitters that get pulled into selling, dopamine and norepinephrine. Dopamine's the feel-good neurotransmitter, and is very much in my mind associated with what I call social selling, be my friend. And that's an important part of selling. The other neurotransmitter, norepinephrine, is associated with stress. And if you just deliver dopamine, you're not a salesperson, you're a customer service rep. But if all you deliver is dopamine in a selling situation, it encourages the prospect to treat us disrespectfully. It encourages the prospect to treat us like a doormat. In fact, I would say that without administering norepinephrine, which I'll discuss in a moment, the average salesperson who does this is giving an engraved invitation to the prospect to be treated like a doormat. To be treated disrespectfully. So the idea behind norepinephrine is we need to challenge the prospect's thinking, and it's got to be fair. And it's a salesperson's job to make it fair. So when we talk about the difference between a social seller and a social seller wants to make friends, a business seller wants to earn the right to profitable business. So if all we have on the team is social sellers, or a way to identify social sellers, is looking at the profitability of their customers. Social sellers typically bring in lower profitable customers because they want to make the customer like them, and one of the best way to make a buyer like you is to cut your price. So salespeople and organizations very often invite disrespect by having an unbalanced presentation that focuses only on dopamine or social selling and not enough on norepinephrine, conflict, challenging the prospect. So I think that's a huge, huge issue I'm hearing about. Although most people wouldn't talk about dopamine and norepinephrine, you know, that's the underlying science. They just say that their salespeople are weak. They're not bold. They're not strong. They don't take a position. And so what often happens then is, you know, like a buyer will say to a salesperson who's selling something, let's say at a dollar, can you do it for 50 cents? Now, the salesperson knows they can't do it for 50 cents, but they say, I'll check with higher authority. Now, in doing that, they give the buyer the thought that maybe it's possible, but they also convey weakness. They should come right back and say, that's a ridiculous price. Nobody could do it for 50 cents. Now, if it's a buck and they ask for 99.5 cents, okay, you know, maybe we could do something. But to go from a dollar to 50 cents, that's ridiculous. And a salesperson should just say, no, we can't do that. That's ridiculous. I don't know if that's more than you wanted, but that's really the essential problem. This lack of boldness, this idea that we want people to like us, and the way that transfers into an inappropriate amount of business development is that business development usually involves a good amount of rejection. And social sellers, nobody likes rejection, but social sellers wanting people to like them, and they're getting rejected, they avoid the behavior. They avoid it because it doesn't cohere with their core, their view of life. You know, they grew up, they learned how to be social sellers when they were preteens or teens. They learned how to make nice. They learned how to be politically correct. And in a way, they were crippled for selling. And they brought that value system into the workforce in their early 20s. And owners kind of scratched their heads and wonder what the heck's going on. Because most owners are entrepreneurial. They're willing to bring the hammer down. They're willing to bring conflict and manage conflict. And they don't understand why the average salesperson doesn't. The average salesperson wants a book of business to manage. They don't want to go out and be a warrior. And so if we don't have a culture that supports the sales warrior and not only supports them but, you know, gives them the tools they need, we typically don't get business development taking place. So those are like the constellation of issues we hear about in the inquiries, although it's mostly we're not opening up enough new sales, and, you know, in some cases, the profitability is off. So that's what we're hearing about. And the curative, which is not an easy one, is changing the sales culture. It's like a culture transplant for the sales team from seeing selling as a slimy event a la Willie Loman and Death of a Salesman to the salesperson as a hero, which I think we talked about in the last segment. So I don't know if that was TMI, too much information or what you wanted, but
no,
hopefully something in there resonated with you and your listeners.
it's great. And, you know, it's taken me three interviews with you to be able to say norepinephrine. So, and I'm probably still not saying it right. However, let's talk about that. So, you know, I've always heard that basically a good salesperson doesn't sell solutions. They sell the problem, then they sell the solution. So if the owner, if the buyer doesn't own the problem first, then they're never going to buy the solution. Now, is that what we're talking about on that side of things?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say that the average salesperson comes in and sells, you know, I sell Scotch tape, as opposed to I sell a solution to things, you know, that the problem is things need to be taped together, and I have a solution for that. And if I could build on that probably mundane example, if you're trying to open up a new account and you can't identify a crisis, you're probably not at a level where someone will listen to you. So early in a conversation, you have to say, the reason why I'm reaching out to you is your business is in crisis. It's on fire. There's a problem. Here's what it is. So for instance, I might say to somebody, there's a recession coming. Do you have an anti-recession selling plan? Well, no, I don't, says the prospect. Now you want to offer a generic solution. So a great anti-recession selling plan involves increasing your market share now. Why? Because in a recession, the activity level is going to fall, and you don't want to have to lay off your core employees. So you want to increase market share right now. Yeah, that makes sense. How do I do that? Well, urgency-based selling is the best way to do it. So it's kind of like a three-step process. What's the crisis? What's the generic solution? So the crisis is, in the example I'm giving, is a recession is coming, winter's coming, danger's coming. What's the solution? Increase market share right now so that when the industry contracts, you could hold your team together. Okay, well, where do I find that solution? Now you're talking to the right guy, and you know, then you then you could sell your specific solution.
And so you mentioned a little bit earlier that most people, most salespeople, are trained to be, you know, be my friend kind of training. Why was that so successful as a sales training method, and why does sales training fail?
Well, part of it is mindset. So if there's a series of interlocking issues. So the first thing is mindset. And if we don't adjust the mindset, we have what I refer to as the rubber band effect. You know, you do the teaching, the mind stretches, but like a rubber band that is stretched, it snaps back into the same position and the learning is lost because the individual being trained is fighting their self-image. So that's a major reason why it fails. Another reason why it fails is it omits dealing with a major aspect of the persuasion process, which is dealing with risk aversion. The typical selling process doesn't address risk aversion. And so that's another reason why sales training fails. But a third subtle reason, and I'm not going to name the brands, but there are branded methods of selling that's out there. And these branded methods, they get kudos from very big Fortune 100, 500 companies. So IBM may say, I used, in a testimonial, we used this branded selling system, and we had fantastic results. And then a smaller entrepreneurial company says, wow, work for IBM should work for me, and then they fail. And the reason is because with IBM, the salesperson is following the brand, which means, you know, everybody knows IBM. If you pick up the phone and say, a salesman says, I'm from IBM, I'd love to come over and tell you about the latest computer-related innovations we have, a typical decision maker would say, sure, it's IBM. If I, from a non-branded company, had the same offering and said, hey, I'm Andy from No Name Company, I've got all these great innovations, I'd love to come over and show you these computer innovations, you hang up on me. So in a big company, the sales force is successful very often because they're following the brand. And so when you get training, it's the brand that's really succeeding. There's a small gap. They don't do this one little thing right. And so these branded systems could come in and fix this little problem, but it's really the brand that's making it work. When you move to small to mid-sized companies, say under $500 million in sales, if they don't have an established brand, then if you use a selling system that depends on a brand, it fails 100 out of 100 times. So what is needed? What is needed is teaching the sales team entrepreneurial skills so they go out and become the brand, right? So that's another major reason why sales training fails, is because it doesn't really amp up the entrepreneurial skill set or supplement it or surround the salesperson with skills they need. The average owner or CEO of a company wants an entrepreneurial salesperson, and when you look at the numbers, they just don't exist. Why don't they exist? Well, if you take something like the DISC profile, which identifies maybe 15-18% of the population is entrepreneurial. Okay, so you got 300 million people. Say it's 20%. That's 60 million people. Half of them are in the workforce. That's 30 million people. There are 27 million small businesses. All the entrepreneurial types are working either in their own small businesses or they're key executives in large organizations. So I think LinkedIn did a study that the most in-demand job, at least in the New York metro area, the last time I looked at it, is salesperson. I think it's ahead of data scientist, or it's one of the top three.
Interesting.
So you can't get that. You usually can't get those people, but what you can do is find what I call a hybrid entrepreneur, and if you teach them the right culture, you give them the right selling tools, and you give them the right selling method, you get entrepreneurial outcomes. And that's what we do with urgency-based selling.
That's fantastic. That's really a great overview. There's a term out there that's used a lot, trusted advisor. And I think the question I have for you is why do we need to become or move towards being a trusted advisor before our experience? I mean, what's more important, being a trusted advisor or experience?
Well, the reason why that's an interesting question is if you talk to the average salesperson, executive, or business owner, and you ask the question, how do you become a trusted advisor, what they'll tell you is, well, you know, you get a little bit of business, then a little bit more, and then maybe after 1, 3, 5 years, you become a trusted advisor. Now, when we're trying to do business development, very often we're going up against a trusted advisor. So try to imagine in your mind's eye a soccer field, which is not level, flat, but it's tilted or canted at like a 30 or 40 degree angle, where the opposition, your competitor, is a trusted advisor, and the ball just rolls down into your net, and you have to kick the ball upfield. It's a hopeless scenario. Typically, we're going on, not always, but very often, we're going in on a single transaction against a trusted advisor, hopeless. So what we need to do is move the prospect to the trusted advisor position, not after 5 years of experience or even one, but before they give us a stick of business. Now, how do you do that? Type three information. Type 1 information is what you know, type 2 is what you know you don't know, and type 3 is what you don't realize you don't know. So you have to start advising your prospect and giving them high-level information, which causes the prospect to start asking him or herself, why the hell am I dealing with the incumbent? You know, Bill here keeps on giving me great advice, which I can use, and I'm getting nothing. And that's what usually leads, with persistence, to opening the closed mind, which, by the way, the core of selling business development is opening the closed mind. And how do we do it? With type 3 knowledge. And what are we doing? We're getting the prospect who's looking down to look up and see a higher mountain or peak of well-being. So that's what entrepreneurial selling is. That's what urgency-based selling is all about, opening the closed mind, getting the prospect to see a higher peak of well-being, and we do it with this type 3 knowledge. And so when owners of businesses or executives wonder why we're not opening up new accounts, which is a key issue, it's because of all this analysis. And that's why we need to become a trusted advisor before experience, because we're competing with trusted advisors. I hope that's responsive.
Yeah, Andy, I always get like a page full of notes every time I talk to you, and it amazes me because this is our third interview. Let me ask you one other question, and that is that often in a sales situation, we'll find that, yes, we're up against that current incumbent advisor. And a salesperson will say, okay, I unseated them. I got the sale. They said they're going to go ahead. And then we find out that they went back and checked with that trusted advisor, and then the sale goes back, you know, goes back to their incumbent.
Right, right. They use those as a whipping boy or whipping girl just to beat
right,
up the
right.
incumbent.
And I've heard of processes, but I'd love to hear your take on that. On how do we have the client, if you will, divorce from the incumbent, so that that sale sticks.
Well, part of the process is asking for fairness all the way along. Another part of the process is really insisting on customer engagement as you're going forward. For instance, I had a first meeting the other day from this wonderful January, and the prospect had read my book. The prospect had skin in the game. It didn't mean they were going to hire me, but they were really showing a high level of engagement. And so, for instance, if the prospect asks you to do something, you got to ask them to do something that's fair and reasonable. Like maybe before that, you know, you give them a proposal. If you have a facility you want them to visit, they come visit, you know, your facility. On a strategy level, though, what you want to do is you want to build a defendable position. Because in my experience, the law of the market is what you described is always going to happen. They're always going to go back and give a second shot to the incumbency. So what you're looking for is a defensive position, something that's hard for the opposition to emulate, something that your customer wants or prospect wants, and that's hard for the prospect, the competition to emulate. So it's some combination of those things, asking for fairness, looking for engagement as you go forward, and then at the strategy level, designing your offer so that it's hard for the other guy or gal to emulate you. That's my quick response.
That's excellent. You know, and that's, you know, listeners, this is why you should go today and look for Urgency-Based Selling, Andy Gold's book, on Amazon, Andy, anywhere you find good books?
Yeah, the title, it describes Urgency-Based Selling, but the title is Innovate Now, Scale Up with 16 Breakthrough Sales Techniques. And they could go to my website to read about it. It's www.urgencybasedselling.net.
Terrific. Okay, well, that's great. You know, once again, as I said, you've given us a lot to think about, a lot of great information, and a lot of good reasons why you might want to call Andy Gold or get in touch with him at urgencybasedselling.net to read his material, hire him as a consultant, or if you're a Vistage member, you might tell your chair to have him come in as a speaker. That's a great use of time for everyone out there today. Andy, thank you so much once again for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again for allowing me to speak to your audience. I always enjoy it. Have a great day, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks, Andy. We're going to take a short break.
Take care.
We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black. And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes, we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rhett Bray.
We'll talk about wellness is how we can start to communicate the importance of wellness and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting, we take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address, either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership. I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers, they make things happen, and sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long-term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get into that leadership position, so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of L.A. doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of L.A. where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money. They're looking to invest in income property. I would say good strategy might be to join up with others who are doing the same. There are some crowdfunding sites that offer some opportunities to do that, but I would be careful just jumping in and talk to an expert in the multifamily business. I think over time it will prove to be lucrative.
Protecting your assets is important, but when you do, it is even more important. Here's attorney Harry Barth.
A very important component to understand is that, as with all business deals, asset protection being just one of them, is to be able to settle a proposed claim within reasonable limits. It's very, very difficult to do that if you're in jeopardy of losing your home, losing your business, and losing your life savings. So I think that it's important that asset protection is granular. We look at the various components, we take into consideration all of the goals and objectives of our particular clients, and there's not one size fits all. Every situation is different, every background is different, every family makeup is different, every business transaction is different.
What's the best way to use Twitter and other social media? We asked expert Tim Templeton.
I just had a friend ask me today, I don't really get Twitter. What is the value? And I said, you know, it's two things. It's self-promotion, or business promotion in this case, and it's research. So if you want people to know who you are and what you're doing, and you create content, you create blog content, you want people to see it, one of the best ways to get it out in front of people is to send out an announcement using Twitter. Likewise, if you're trying to find people in your ecosystem, your business, the analysts, the resellers, the potential partners, you can find them by their activity on Twitter. You can interact with them, you can follow them, you can retweet things that they're sending, and you can create a relationship that way, which is a lot easier than it used to be.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
Of all the things that can happen on the way to the sale of your business, having a deal fall apart because of sloppy financials is probably the worst. Here's expert Addison Adams.
In the sale of a company, you are in a very cooperative process with the other side. If you're the seller of the business and the buyer is coming in and evaluating whether to buy your business, there needs to be a high level of trust there. A trust that you are not only being open and honest about your business and what you know about it, but also credibility that you know what you're talking about. And that when you hand over your financial statements, for example, they're clean, they're correct, they're complete, and they're not misleading. Preferably they're audited, and not only currently audited, but going back several years. And this is so that there is a confidence that comes in from the point of view of the buyer.
You're the trustee of your company's 401k or profit sharing plan. You have certain responsibilities. What can happen when things go wrong? We ask Buck Blanton.
We have a responsibility when we run qualified plans as a business owner, or in that world we call it a plan sponsor. That person has a responsibility of due care and due loyalty to the participant. And sometimes we forget that when we run plans and we do other things. But as you said, those breaches can become kind of onerous. The 2013 audit year, there were 3,566 audits performed by the Department of Labor, and more than $2.7 billion with a B dollars in fines and penalties were levied. All of those things can be done and levied against corporate officers personally. It's not your corporate seat that might get sued or levied. It's going to be you personally.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me once again. And it's great to have back people that have been with me before to give me updates on what they've been up to. My next guest is Jim Muehlhausen. He's been with us many times before. He's with a company called Half Retire, a company and a concept that he started. And, you know, the concept is, you know, a lot of business owners I talk to say, you know, I'm not quite ready to sell my business or turn it over to someone else at this point, but I sure would like to get some of my time back. I'd like to get some of my life back. So Jim's going to tell us how to do that with the concept called Half Retire. Jim, well, welcome once again. Thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Great to be on the show.
Hey, Jim, we've talked about this concept a couple times, but for those listeners who may not have heard before, tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you came up with the concept of Half Retire and what it's all about.
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to grow up with a family business and kind of caught the bug as a kid and have owned several businesses over the year. And eventually I got into the peer consulting business or the peer roundtable business. And in working with business owners all across the world, I started to see things popping up probably 10 years ago where people that should be selling their businesses were not. And I think they were not selling them for a couple of reasons. One, they didn't like the idea of what I call full retirement. You know, there's only so much golf I can play. There's, you know, I'll be bored. My wife loves me, but not that much. Those type of things were what I heard. And then you had another group that couldn't afford to retire. They were making a nice income on their business, but they couldn't sell that business for enough money to fund their retirement the way that they would like to fund it. And so by basically stealing good ideas from business owners, I cobbled together a program along with IP that I had and kind of synthesized it into what we call Half Retire.
Yeah. And for most people, it conjures up a picture that I'll still be involved in something that I built, something that I love, and something that I probably, as you mentioned, need to continue for income purposes. But that concept of half retire means I can have a couple days off, or maybe a couple weeks off, or maybe more than that. So when most people first talk to you about this, what's their notion of what it would look like? What do you think they're thinking that they're looking for, and what they picture it would look like for them?
Yeah, so our goal for people is to work 2 half days a week and keep their current level of income. Now, a lot of people actually want to work more than that. It kind of surprised me. I'm like, well, we can get you down to that. How come you want to work 3 days a week or 4 days a week? But you can define it however you want. I've got people that say, boy, if I could just take a Friday afternoon off and go to the movies or go to the gym, that'd be a lot better than I'm doing now. So you can define it however you want. In fact, we were talking updates a second ago, and I've got a book coming out finally on the topic. Only took 2 years to get it written. And the title says it all. It's half retire, keep your business, ditch the stress. And I think that that's what people want. They want to get off that grind that a business can turn into.
You know, a lot of business owners that we work with, Jim, are let's just put it out there. They're control freaks. They've built it. They know that, you know, what they do works, and they might not trust delegating things to other people. How do business owners that fit that description, start transitioning towards being able to delegate effectively and trust that things will get done? I mean, that's in their head. How do they do that?
Well, I think it's more than that. I mean, yes, we're all control freaks, and yes, we like it done the way we want it done, and there's all these impediments to delegating. But one of the things that we teach is to actually stop trying to delegate. I know you're probably going, what are you talking about? Why would you stop delegating? And it's
right.
Because, have you ever met a business owner that has not tried to delegate? Let's just say they're 50. They're old enough. They know how to delegate. They understand what it is. It's not like they're saying, oh, my gosh, this delegation thing, never heard of that before. Perhaps I should try it. They've tried it. They've delegated what they can, and it's not going to work anymore. And so until they find another way to, all we call it offloading, to offload that work, delegation is not the answer. I don't believe that delegation in its traditional form works for entrepreneurs. What we like to do is called unbundling. Because what ends up happening, if you think about an entrepreneur's day or week, they're doing 50 different things. It's this hairball. And you can't just hand off the hairball. It's got to be untangled. And that's a lot of the work that we do at Half Retires. You got to figure out how to untangle it. So the first piece is finding what we call your Picasso work. That inside that hairball, there's a whole bunch of stuff that is very delegable, that is very easy for someone else to do, but you've got to fractionalize it and find the pieces that someone else can in fact do. But the Picasso work, you know, the touching of the brush to the canvas, you know, the signing of the painting, has to be done by Picasso. No one else can do that. Mm-hmm. And every business owner has that Picasso work that cannot be delegated. It is undelegable. And as soon as you come to that realization that I'm never going to get rid of this small amount of work, then right. You can figure out how to offload the rest and untangle that mess.
Very good. Very good. So it takes a lot of analysis. I mean, you know, I've sat down with a lot of business owners and said, you know, tell me everything you do, and they run out of paper. It's just, when they really think about it, when they walk around for a week or a month and write down every time they do a topic, like you said, there's a lot of things that they do that they should not be doing. How much can they offload, or what percentage would you say is that Picasso work of what they do now?
Well, I used to call this fractional delegation 98-2 delegation, figuring that the 2% was the Picasso work. Mm-hmm. And that would be a gold standard, right? You can do that, but I'll speak for myself. When I was before this was a refined concept, I had a manufacturing company, I had about 50 people, I owned it for 9 years, and I was able, using a process that was a lot less sophisticated, cut my work in half 3 times in 18 months.
Hmm. Wow.
So that's 12%. Now I'm down to 12% of what I used to do. And obviously I filled the gap with a whole bunch more work. I was younger and more energetic back then. But it can be done.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good point. So for owners that say, you know, if I were to cut my work down to 12% and then my business is still running great, should I be working on making my business more valuable? Is that what I should be doing with my extra time now? Should I be, what should I, you know, and if so, what should I be doing in that regard?
Well, and certainly guys like you and me are going to say, yes, that's a great idea, because A, making it run better without you does in fact make it more valuable. I'm sure all of your work and the type of work that people in the exit community do would tell you that a business that runs well without the owner is easier to sell and sells for more money than one that does not.
Yes, and also if they do decide to turn it over to key employees or family members, it's got a lot better chance of sustaining, of being sustainable, because a horrible percentage of businesses that transfer from one generation to the next sustain, right?
I'm living proof of that. You've heard the shirt sleeve to shirt sleeve in three generations. I am the third generation. It was a very nice business for the first two. They did very well. I never got to touch it. They went and sold it, but the business isn't even in existence. You know, a business that made a lot of people wealthy isn't even around anymore.
Yeah, that it's a very small percentage. I think it's less than 10% make it to the third generation, if my memory serves me correctly. So let me ask you a question. How would a business owner know if they should be thinking about half retire?
Well, we make the contention that it is the same as you do, that exit planning is a good thing, right? That there's no downside to doing it other than the work, and I'll hold the same thing out for half retire. But I think that the acid test is someone feeling like they would like to cut back a little bit? You know, have they, I had a woman that started the program early on, and she had promised her husband that they would retire together. And when she was talking to me, that was 2 years prior, you know, so she's like, I haven't kept my promise. And my grandkids are at that golden age, you know, they were 8 to 10-ish, and I'm missing it. You know, and she had a great business, still has a great business, had a great business, but she just couldn't figure out how to carve out that time for the other things in her life. And through, in her case, it was a lot of the mindset work that we do. You know, you were talking about control freaks. That's a little bit on our mindset stuff. They're a little bit more coming from a different place than that. But we have found that until the mindsets align with half retirement, you're not going to be able to half retire.
Right. It's got to start in your head. Right.
So I'll give you one for instance. We say you can get things done the way you like them done, or you can half retire.
Okay. And you know, all exit planning groups that I talk to and interview say the same thing. If the owner doesn't have some kind of an idea what they'll do with their time, either after they sell their business or transition out or whatever you want to call it, then they're probably going to defer, not do anything, because it's a lot easier to just keep doing what you do. They're used to it. It's been 30 years. You know, it's their day to day. It's the devil they know, right? So that's a big part of it. Does half retire help them examine that, what they'll do with that time, so that they have that you know, something to go to?
Yeah, that's actually phase one. We call it the magnet phase. You have to have a magnet. We want a magnetic force pulling you towards half retirement, not it to be yet one more thing to do, right? So that's along the lines of what you're talking about. And actually, the mindsets are step two that I mentioned in our six-step process. But yes, you need it. But I think that there's a little bit of appeal to half retire that isn't this massive hard turn of what am I going to do when I don't have this business anymore. You know, we always say that in half retirement, you can pick the work that you do. You don't have, you know, a lot of people don't like to sell, for instance, but they're the best salesperson there. So now they're stuck selling. Well, there's a way out of that. It's a process. There's a way out of doing that. We find the Picasso work, you probably still need to do some of it, but it'll be much more palatable if you're doing 20% of what you're doing now. You know, we always ask people, would that bother you? And they go, heck no, losing 80% of something I don't enjoy, that's fine. It's a lot better than it was yesterday. And so that's what we're trying to do, is get it down to the work you enjoy, get rid of the work that you don't enjoy, and usually you enjoy your Picasso work anyway, because you're good at it.
makes sense. Now, there are a lot of business owners out there who would say, you know, I don't know if that could ever work for my business because I am, you know, I am the business, and I guess that's the point in the first place. Does half retire work for any business, Jim?
It depends on what you mean by work, right? If you mean, can I take a one-person business and get them no additional help, whether it be a contractor or an employee, and cut their work down to 2 half-days a week? Probably not. Can we take that business, and we have lots of people with one-person businesses that are in the half-retire program, and do all of the things that we're talking about to a pretty significant degree? Absolutely. But we may not be able to, you know, take someone with a 100-person company or a 500-person company that has different set of resources to play with, you know, tools in the box, if you will. You know, that's going to be easier to get that down to only the work that you like, you know, 2 half-days, et cetera.
Okay. So it's all, you know, a matter of what you're looking for. But in any event, it's a good exercise to help you claw back some of your time, which is what a lot of people are craving because they've been doing what they do for many, many, many years, and start setting up a business that's more sustainable in any event, right? I mean, it seems like anybody who goes through the process is going to come out better no matter what the outcome.
100% of the time, yes.
So your book is now out, and it's called Half Retire?
It will be out in May. It will be available for pre-order pretty shortly here, so look for it on Amazon as it comes out, probably about a month ahead of the May 15th release date. But yes, Half Retire, Keep Your Business, Ditch the Stress.
Love it. And in any event, people can find a free guide to half retirement at www.halfretire.com. Again, that's www.halfretire.com. And in your experience, you've been doing this for a few years now. What kind of comments do you get from people a year or 2 years after they've started the program?
Yeah, I got a real nice note from one of the first 10 people to go through the program, you know, 3-4 years ago, who said that he's now on track. The company, he's got kids in the business, so that was his goal. It's a fairly significant enterprise. And he wanted his family to have a business that, you know, was transferable and didn't blow up, like you said. He had key people that he wanted to take care of. That's another big priority that people have is, hey, these people have given me 30 years of their life. I want to take care of them and make sure their jobs are secure when I'm not as involved. And so he's spent a couple of years, having the company buy back all the stock. He now has no investment in the company at all. We're talking about millions of dollars that he's now extracted from the company. He's cut his workload to 3 days a week. Most importantly, this is the one I think a lot of people struggle seeing their way to, is he has no customer involvement. He was the face of the business. I mean, he was the man. And he has zero customer interaction, you know, 2 years later. And he said that he's getting it to the point where he, you know, wouldn't have to go into work if he did not want to. But then he wrote me an interesting note. He said, I have realized that work is part of my social life and that I have no idea what I would do other than go to Walmart with my wife if I didn't have to go to work. And so I think that he's kind of picked up on the importance of that Picasso work, that work that only he can do at the level he can do it, and he wants to do it, and the business needs him to do it. There's a lot of value in that Picasso work.
Oh, yeah, a ton of value, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But there's so much of the hairball that he doesn't want to do. So, yeah, there's only, you know, it takes an hour if you're really intentional to walk the dog. There's that trip to Walmart. You know, if you play golf every day of your life, God bless you, but you'll probably go crazy. So what else do you do with those hours in the day? So if you have that time back, you can be very, very intentional about setting guidelines and goals for the future of the business, if you so desire. So I think it's a great service that you're providing business owners, and I encourage all of our listeners to go check out halfretire.com and find out about it, because, you know, so this is something, if someone wanted to start, they can start from anywhere in the country. You're based in Indiana, but they can start anywhere in the country, right?
Absolutely. We've got coaches physically in many of the markets across the country, about 30, 35 markets. We have people physically there. But the program is, if you take the course, that is an online learning portal. It's a learning management system that walks you through how to half retire step by step. And then there's coaching available alongside that for people that want it.
Well, it's a great concept, great notion. I really appreciate you coming back on to bring us up to date on how things have been going for you, and look forward to the book coming out a little bit later this year in May 2020. And again, best of luck to you, and thanks very much for coming on, Jim. Appreciate it.
All right. Always good to be on, and best wishes to you, Bill.
Thanks a lot. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey, everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on exitcoachradio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.